rapid, and as soon as you ran out of range, the guns are so mobile, they again can very quickly pick up position and move forward. Not as quickly as a self-propelled, but nevertheless, extremely mobile. We ran into very few problems that way. Our basic problems were that periodically we'd be nicely told that we were perhaps expending a little too much ammunition. There was a war going on. And
yeah.
Did all have to come across the water.
Yeah.
Take it easy and stuff like that. But never had any complaints about petrol. Although when you're on the chase, there were times that we were practically out of it. But they'd catch up to you and keep you supplied. And very few problems with breakdowns. We had a marvelous mechanical. Our equipment was in good shape when we went over there, and we had very few gun breakdowns and very few vehicle breakdowns.
Tell me, when you were operating with one of these units up forward, and the fire was called, you presumably would be with the company commander or
yeah.
He would say, there is a building over there, and you could see it from where you were.
Yeah, he'd say, Clerkson, you see that woods over there? Well, we're taking too much static from them. Let's neutralize it. Let's see what we can flush out of there. So I'd call down the troop fire, and if we couldn't do anything with that, I'd try battery fire. And there was the odd, I had the command of regimental fire. And under certain circumstances, I could actually go up to division. I would have to clear it through headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
I'd ask for a mic target. It would be regimental, and I forget the name of the other one at this stage of the game, but it would have to be cleared. And so we did have tremendous firepower at our resources, limited only by the availability of ammunition. And of course, the powers to be knew what their next move was going to be before we did. So if something big was coming up, they'd be more inclined to be watching the expenditure
yeah.
on the little diddly things that you were fooling around with that particular day. Or if they knew nothing was coming on for a week, they may allow you more leeway. But basically, that's the way it went. And in order to do this, you were, as you say, you were up with them, sometimes you'd have to leave them and go out in the knoll here, there, or anywhere in order to put yourself in a position that you could properly see and direct fire onto your target.
You would have to find yourself an observation post. Then
that's
off,
right.
Off remote from the...
Yeah.
To some extent, yeah.
This is where your mobility came in, and you take your signaler with you and this radio, and away you go. And that didn't happen too often. Basically, if I was with the armor, I pretty well stayed with the tank, and the infantry pretty well stayed on the ground with them, because you were of no value to them if you went off on your own and got sniped and out of action. They weren't interested in you being out of action. They were interested in you being productive for them. So you watched that pretty closely. They didn't like you going off, in fact.
Well, you were with, then you were approaching the Salle Gap, I suppose. And,
So then, as you say, we worked our way down the line into the Salle Gap situation, which is extremely interesting. I never thought that I'd see anything the like of that in my lifetime. And then didn't really realize the immensity of it until it was over and we continued to advance. And then saw the carnage that was wrecked by not only by our artillery but by the Air Force. A tremendous carnage. By the time we got down to the closing of the gap, as far as we got it closed, we were on the hill overlooking river. I think the little village was called St. Lambert sur Dives.
Oh, yeah.
And you could see the Germans down in the valley trundling along, trying to get heading east towards Germany. Eh? Very few vehicles, horses, and soldiers marching. So you'd bring artillery fire down on them, and they'd stop, and a wave of them would come up and give themselves up. And this is the way it went for a couple of days. At night, this particular hill that we were on was savagely attacked every night by the forces, because they knew that they wanted to neutralize it so they could continue on. And
who were the infantry with you?
We were with the Argyle and Southern Hounds at that time, and the Colonel Sturt and Major Dave. Oh, his name will come. He's won the Victoria Cross. I shouldn't forget.
Oh, Curry?
Yeah, Dave Curry. Yeah, Major Dave Curry.
South Alberta.
Yeah. And it was really an unexpected artilleryman's dream, in a way, that how could one ever visualize so much target? And yet it seemed to be, in retrospect, such a wasteful thing that it was almost... all that mass of humanity down there, and you were allowed to be up there and neutralizing it, trying to neutralize it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And I'm sure those pilots must have felt the same way. They must have. They must have seen that below them and said, "My God, whatever brought me into this, and what do I do now?" You know.
I presume there, between you and me, there was a considerable defensive line, German defensive line.
Oh, yeah, there were. These were the people that were attacking me. Vigorously and viciously at night.
Trying to keep the gap open. Yeah.
And at that particular time, there was no hang-up on ammunition. They, when we arrived at this hill and saw what was before us, I called for a Mike target, which is the regimental target, and they passed it through, and then very nicely sent word up to watch the ammunition expenditure, and I just sent the signal back that for every Mike target, we appear to be getting about 500 to 1,000 prisoners, which was the truth.
Yeah.
And that was the last I heard about watching the ammunition
expenditure. You
figured it was worth it? Yeah. As a matter of fact, I've often looked back on those couple of hot, sunny days, and I kept saying, you know, clerks, and you should get down there and get a few of the goodies that are coming up, the Lugers and the this and the that. And my thoughts were, oh, I don't want to carry that stuff all through the campaign. You know, I'll get some of that later.
Yeah.
Never did get around to it.
You never did get around
to
it. No. I'll be darned. Yeah.
But it was just unbelievable. So.
Well, you had a defensive position provided by the tanks.
I had a defensive position up in this hill provided by them.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you under any shell fire?
Yes, we were under shell fire, and there were some 88 poking around. The second afternoon, I had some radio problems, and I tumbled back to the gun position to get them fixed up and was chased by an 88 all the way back and all the way back to the old pip again. But an 88 was in a very unfortunate position that he had absolutely no crest clearance. He was so fast, it was just sort of a straight trajectory.
Yeah.
So as soon as you knew one was anywhere around, you just kept on the other side of a knoll and wandered through little valleys and hills, and every time he'd get sight of you, he'd plonk something at you, but managed to evade him that way.
There was no regular artillery, in the sense that...
The German 88...
Howitzer fire or anything like that?
The German 88 apparently was originally a fabulous anti-tank gun.
Still was used.
An anti-aircraft gun, pardon me, that
proved
itself out in Africa and then lowered the sights and used it as just an all-around gun. And that, plus their mortars, were generally what we encountered. They had tremendous mortars, a tremendous number of them. And I really was up against more mortar fire in my particular job than gunfire because of the proximity to them. Our guns would be under their gunfire more than I was, more than we were, let's put it that way. Yeah. So that was an extreme... extremely interesting experience, one that anybody experienced would never forget, and a very sad experience in a way to see so much humanity involved.
Yeah. How many days were you there at this OP?
I would say a couple, if I recall. We would be there a couple of days, and it was all over.
And all this time, whenever there was light, you could keep an eye on this.
Yeah.
You could see this.
Yeah, all day long.
You must have been in action all day long.
And all day long, and got very little sleep at night because of the continuous attacks on the position, and we were bringing down defensive fire on them.
On your own position?
On the Germans that were attacking us.
I see, yeah.
At night, we had some defensive fire programs set up that all you had to do, we called it defensive fire, and you just range it in. And
during the day, before you
called it quits, range it in so that they had all the particulars of the guns, and if the Germans came up that line at night and they were detective, all you did was just send down a signal, defensive fire, and the guns would fire on that pre-ranged target and neutralize them. It worked very effective because you couldn't see to do anything else at night.
Yeah, right.
So that was the end of that.
So you, was this where you won your military cross?
That was the campaign or the...
The incident.
The incident and where I won the military cross, because I had to get out do a considerable amount of rambling and rummaging and exposing and this, that, and the other thing to provide some effective...
In order to see your target.
Yeah.
You have to expose yourself.
Yeah. And in order to support Major Dave Curry in various attacks. While he was down doing a tremendous job in that village, holding them off from decimating him, and allowing us to continue doing what we were doing, he was being continuously attacked. So he would call down... He would want artillery fire from me, and I had quite difficulty in getting finding out or seeing, you know, just exactly what he wanted neutralized. So I'd have to go out.
Stick your head up and have a look.
Stick your head around the bushes.
You must have felt a bit naked.
Get blasted for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you get caught up in the excitement of it.
Yeah. Well, you're doing it just as a matter of interest. When you were more or less isolated, or were you doing your own cooking? How would you, your supply?
Yeah.
Were you on iron rat? Your food
we'd,
rations?
We'd have our little cooking utensils, excuse me, and do our own cooking, and take rations with us from our own people, but if we were out too long, we'd get draw rations from the army or the infantry.
All this time, you only had one signaler?
When I speak of what signaler, I'm speaking of the one signaler who came with me all the time, either in the Jeep or the tank, and who also had the mobile equipment. There were two signalers at the old PEP at all times. There was a driver in the tank. We had a driver and two other people, both whom trained in signaling. In the Jeep, we just had the signaler who he or I would drive it. It was wasn't used as much, but it was quite mobile at times, and very effective. I was looked back in that era and thought the Canadian artillery, which is of course what should I say, derived from the British system, they had a very effective modus operandi.
Mm-hmm.
Very effective.
When, after this two-day period, when things had quietened a bit, you drove up and through, you advanced through the...
Carnage.
The carnage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We then had orders to proceed further, and I cannot remember the exact details, except we drove all day along the road that previous to us, the engineers had to go and clear with bulldozers.
Really? Yeah.
The carnage was so bad from the Air Force, and the horses just laying there dead and smelly, and the vehicles, it was unbelievable. I've often wished that I had a camera with me that I could have recorded some of it, because you see it in your mind as we sit here and talk about it now, but I've never actually seen any photographs of it. It must
be. Very few. I've seen one or two, and I've seen them a number of times, so there couldn't be very many, at least
not in publication. I don't know, but what it wasn't the photograph, the type of photograph that the Canadian Army wanted. Perhaps that has something to do with it.
Oh, yeah, maybe. There may well be plenty of them sitting around in Ottawa somewhere.
Yeah.
But,
could be.
Yeah. And even during all this, you were right, you didn't pick up any of your souvenirs.
No. No. Well, actually, at that particular day, we didn't want to stop to pick up anything. Just
get out of the smell.
Yeah, just get out of the smell. Get away from it all.
Yeah.
I can't remember exact details, Bill, but it wasn't but a couple of days after that that we ran into some more German Army resistance and started to sort of slow down and bog down. And as they, it's been called pretty well the end of the chase across Normandy.
Yeah.
And then started to run into the canals in Belgium.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, before then, you got a new divisional commander.
We got a new divisional commander, and
General Foster, I guess.
General Foster came into play, and at my level now,
it didn't affect me, except
word came down, and that's about the only effect it had, because you're down there on the ground at the company level, if you want to call it that,
and
you never saw them. The only effect it would have is how well the battle went. Yep.
Hmm. So you started this chase across from Falaise off into Belgium, right? You were.
The chase was just at Falaise, after Falaise, and chased them across into Belgium, where they finally sort of regrouped. As soon as they came to these natural water obstacles that we, well, of course, don't, I'm sorry, we've got the Seine and the Somme now across, and they were minor incidents. There was a lot of bullets whistling around and things like this, but they really weren't in a position to stop crossings, and
there
nor
no
did they,
no,
no, nor did they attempt to, just some minor rear guard action. Things carried on the way we went.
Did you go? You went into gun positions, I suppose, in these various places.
They went in, took up gun positions on the banks, of course, and as the infantry in the army.
Were you really going sort of hell for leather? Or were you
at times we were going hell for leather. I was with my armor. Oh yeah, and I mean this is when we were getting shot up by the Air Force. The odd times, you see, there were no lines. They never knew where any lines were, and they saw a column going down the road, hell bent for election. I think they were a little overexcited. Maybe they were having a contest back in their messes in England. I don't know who chewed up the most vehicles that day, but they tended to take them on rather than go down and have a look to see who they were.
Were you? Did you have white stars on your vehicle, or were you taking them off by then?
No, we had white stars in our vehicle.
Did you? Because some were removed because they provided perfect aiming points for the Germans, of course.
No, we had white.
And I've seen an operation order to that effect. It wasn't with your. It wasn't your division, as a matter of fact. But
that particular time we did.
So and, the one. And it wasn't a bad idea either. It was had white stars.
Yeah.
Like a sore thumb.
Yeah, that's right. When you look on it in retrospect, you say, well, my gosh, they're going to go to all this problems and all this camouflage. Who needs white stars?
Yeah.
Who needs anything?
You could see it through half a foot of bush, couldn't you, really?
Yeah. I guess somebody had to have a few.
Does this light go on behind here? Because I wanted to check my tape. No, it's turned off. Maybe yours goes on, doesn't it?
Your insignia on there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we've got a bit further. I just didn't want to run off, so. The population was delighted to see you. Were they,
yeah,
the
you know, they welcome you and they push you. Their particular home brew, I think we used to call it Calvados and coal oil and whatever else at you, and that particular time, fruit and whatever they had. They were very, very pleased, of course, and that gave you an uplift, because it must be a very depressing thing to go into any country in a military way and be fighting an enemy, and then when the enemy withdraws, to find that you've got an alien population that,
yeah.
you know,
oh,
that
yeah.
you're still fighting. It's, that we didn't have to experience that. But basically, you were just so involved, I suppose, in everyday work and survival and comradeship that they passed very, very quickly, extremely quickly. When I look back on how fast that time went, it's because one was busy.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's true. Yeah. You ever run into the poles in any way, or?
Yes, as a matter of fact, around Philae, I ran into the poles, only by, I don't know whether he was on the wrong road or I was on the wrong road. Probably both of us were on the wrong road, and I just ran into. I was out with my tank and looking for an old pip, and a couple of Polish tanks come roaring along, and he. Spoke English very well and warned me that there was some Germans up the road looking for us, and I said, well, that's fine. We're looking for them, too, and that was the only meeting I ever had with them.
Yeah.
They were, to my knowledge, they were very aggressive. They had a lot of scores to settle and very aggressive, and I've heard very excitable. I don't know whether they were or not, because I really never fought
yeah.
direct. They had some very bad luck, of course, with being bombed by the Americans. That must have deflated them something terrible as well, physically, mentally. That was a hell of a thing. And but on the whole, and so far as I know, a tremendous asset. We were always glad to know the Poles were on our flank.
Yeah.
You know. We, as a matter of fact, our fighting seemed to be with the British on one flank and the Poles on the other, and that was always a good feeling. You knew that the Poles would be in there punching away, and the British would be steady as a rock at Gibraltar, and they both expected you to get the hell in there and push through.
Yeah,
you know?
Do your bit. Yeah.
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 So that it was no problems that way.
But
at all.
You weren't involved then in any of the coastal battles, the ports or anything like that. Of course, being in.
No.
In Fort Div, you...
No, in Fort Div, we then took off toward Ghent.
Yeah.
And just at the Leopold Canal is where my particular story ends, because at that particular point, an 88 shell met up with me and put me out of action for the rest of the war.
Oh, boy.
So this was...
You were in a jeep or in a
This
was
in September. Actually, no, we were just scouting along the road with Colonel Stir of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, scouting around, waiting for the Algonquins to get across this particular little canal, to which was just prior to the Leopold Canal. They had a real tough show, and they actually got across and had to come back again. And we were scouting along the road, and the 88th picked us up, and I was just unlucky enough to meet up with one.
Mm-hmm.
So my story ends there, because I was hospitalized, eventually sent back to England, and the patched up there, but it was 9 months before I get back to the continent again.
What were your experiences in the, after being wounded, in the sense, through the evacuation process?
Tremendous. As soon as I was wounded, I was immediately whipped into the regimental aid post. A field ambulance came on, roared in, which was a jeep with four stretchers in it. Took me up to a larger aid post, I forget the name of it, where in each one of these, they take a look at you and give you the necessary shots or what have you, and bandages, and then into a larger ambulance where they took you into a larger unit, and I ended up in Dieppe, in a large hospital in Dieppe.
Oh, really? heard you. Mm-hmm.
And then along, let's see, in the ambulance I went from the field into the F. I was, there were two Germans and two Canadians in there. And, and we talked, one of them talked English, so we pretty well groaned and talked all the way in, or moaned and talked. And in the hospital, in the hospital, they sort of wheeled you into a great big clearing room where they had everybody in there from Russia to England, I suppose, in all ranks, and sort of looked after you as best they could, and then sorted you out the next day, and operation, this, that, and the other thing, but just tremendous. The Canadian medical people were, in my opinion, just top.
Mm-hmm.
They just worked night and day, and I believe very well equipped, and certainly very attentive, and gave you the best they had. So they were, they did a tremendous job in getting people patched up and back again.
So you were shipped off eventually. How long were you in Dieppe before you were shipped to England?
I was in Dieppe perhaps a week while they assessed the situation and then decided who had to go back to England for operations and treatment and put on the hospital ship and sent to England. Now this would be the end of September, I guess. Because of the nature of my wounds, I wasn't able to be operated on. I had shrapnel in the lung. So I was only able to be operated on in January.
Hmm.
Well, it's all healed up. Then,
yeah.
Then they had to cut everything out, open and remove it. And then that took another few months to get over that. So the total period was 9 months.
Yeah. Where were you in hospital in England?
Not very far from the present Gatwick Airport in the Horley, a little Canadian hospital at Horley, H-O-R-L-E-Y.
Hmm.
Tremendous, quite a modern hospital for that period. As a matter of fact,
it had been a civilian hospital, had it then? Or
yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, quite modern.
Mm-hmm.
Low individual units, almost like these single army barracks that we see over in Gordon Head here.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Each one,
yeah.
All brick construction, flat roof, and a central operating room and common room and what have you. Beautifully, beautiful design. And I've seen it since the war, about 4 or 5 years ago. We were over there and found it again. And it's like these British buildings made of brick. It doesn't look a day different.
Doesn't it?
No, still being used as a hospital. Different paint color in the walls,
yeah,
inside.
Did you go in and have a look?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure went in and wandered around.
Told them why you were there?
As a matter of fact, I think they're just so used to Canadians wandering in the place, they didn't seem to pay any attention to me. I just wandered around.
More Canadian tourists.
Yeah, more Canadians looking for their old man, I guess.
Yeah. Have you been back to Normandy?
So,
just as an aside here.
No. I just wanted to say that before going back to Normandy, after that, we were privileged to go up and spend a week at Vincent Matthews' rest home up in Derbyshire.
Mm-hmm.
He was then the Canadian High Commissioner, and he had a beautiful mansion up there. It's absolutely beautiful place.
It was a convalescent home for
officers. Sort
of
a convalescent home for officers. You'd
yeah.
go up there for a little R&R. And they'd have horseback riding and bicycle riding and walks and a masseur, and they had people teaching you how to do leather work, and it was just a tremendous place. Meals fit for a king, and he'd show up every weekend.
Really? Oh, yeah.
And they'd all sit down to a nice dinner with them. And just
how many of their work?
I would guess there'd be about 25.
Oh, yeah.
There. Then I was fortunate enough to go back into the artillery pool at near Aldershot and actually be posted back to my regiment.
Well, that's an oddity, wasn't it, or a rarity?
Very much of a rarity.
Yeah.
Actually be posted back to my regiment, where they quickly posted me back to the battery, and the battery commander said, "I've been waiting for a holiday, take over." he went on holiday.
Well, where were you at that point?
At that point, we were in the middle of Holland, just sitting there waiting to come home. The war was over now.
Yeah.
This is now June 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'll be darned, yeah. So you didn't, there was no actual fighting in, but you just, I gather by that time in Holland, the troops were having a pretty fair time.
By that time in Holland, the Dutch people had taken the Canadians into their homes and into their arms and were just treating them like members of the family. And every night you were invited out to someone's home for, the Dutch were tremendous music people. They just loved to sit there and play music. They'd put their violins and their cellos and their clarinets, and they'd all have little groups, I don't know what you'd call them, and you'd be invited into a home, have some tea or coffee and music and conversation, and the hospitality was tremendous.
Huh.
Marvelous people. They were very hard done by, of course, food-wise and clothing-wise,
yeah,
and that. And they were just getting on their feet, and they were quite grateful for it all. When we didn't leave until January. We went to England in January, but when we left Holland, we pretty well left all our spare socks and underwear and those items of clothing, because they still didn't have too much.
You were there that long, all through 45, were you?
I was in Holland from June 45 until January 46.
Well, there couldn't have been much rest left for the regiment by that time.
No, they were gradually, there were a group that volunteered to fight in the Pacific.
Yeah.
They took off.
They left first, I guess.
Yeah.
Pretty
they
well.
Were the compassionate people that were sent home early on compassionate grounds, such as age, some problem, business problems, or family problems.
Yeah.
Or something. So, you know, the regiment started to thin out, but not that much because, you know, the tremendous movement control problems they had in getting people back home. They just had to wait your turn. So that's what it was all about. But in the meantime, they commandeered or rented a complete hotel on the north coast of Holland. The 4th Canadian Armored Division did, at Noordwijk-aan-Zee, and every regiment had an allotment there. So about once a month, you were up there for a week. We went on leave to Paris and leave to Belgium and leave here and leave there. So it was work and play.
Yeah, pretty soft way to fight a war, eh?
Yeah, pretty soft way
right
to fight
down
a war.
It,
yeah.
Yeah. So you went back to England in 46?
So then we went back to England to the staging unit there, or again near Aldershot, and then came home quite quickly. We came home in January 46.
Mm-hmm.
And although I started from the prairies, by the time we came home, my family moved to Vancouver, and the Canadian Army would discharge you anywhere in Canada.
Yeah.
So I asked them to ship me out to Vancouver, which they did. And
were you married this time?
No.
No.
I met my wife, Lois, who is a Canadian nursing sister. I met her in Paris while we were on leave. And
did you?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, we met in the Canadian Officers Club in Paris. And we married in Canada after our return.
For heavens, I should talk to her. Yeah.
Get Lois's version of the war.
Find out her version of the war, yeah.
Yeah.
And what you were discharged to Vancouver.
So that I was discharged in a little mountain in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was the end of our military career, except for a short stint in the militia in Vancouver.
Yeah. But you didn't join right away. You joined some years later, I think.
Yeah, a few years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vesper Army.
You never went back to university?
No, I went into business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't go back to university.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, well, that's great, Harold. Thanks very much for your...
We
timed that just about right. We're practically at the end of the tape.
Is that right? God, I didn't think that much would come out.
Hey, well, there you are. I told you. You might be surprised. Yeah, thank you.